There was one man who, he used a rather graphic metaphor. He said the scorpion has to be stamped on, meaning Saddam, obviously. If it's not an Iraqi shoe, then let it be an American one. But then he went on to say that he was worried that the Americans might not leave quickly after having stamped on the scorpion. And this is what he said: the Iraqi people will rebuild their house the day after Saddam goes. If the US tries to meddle, we will fight them to the last breath. Iraqis hate Saddam, but they love their country more.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulibi. Jonathan Steele's new book is called Defeat: Why America and Britain Lost Iraq. The senior foreign correspondent for The Guardian newspaper dissects the war in Iraq and explains how it could have been fought more successfully. Steele puts the blame on a long history of Western imperialism in the Middle East, plus a driving ideology that he says was informed by abstract neoconservative theory rather than geopolitical realities. Steele has covered Iraq since 2003. He draws from the experiences and voices of Iraqi sources. Their forceful analysis informs the book's soul. Steele believes one solution to the Iraq tragedy might be a negotiated withdrawal, bringing what he hopes might be, quote, an orderly and relatively casualty-free departure. This reading of Defeat was recorded in March 2008 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
Well, thank you very much for coming. It's a great pleasure and honor to see so many people here. I always like coming to Washington. I lived here for 4 years in the 1970s when I was the correspondent for the same paper that I still work for, The Guardian. And it was particularly nice to come back this time and be greeted on Sunday when I arrived by this wonderful review in the Washington Post Book World, which perhaps some of you saw. I mean, if I'd been asked to review my own book, I don't think I could have done such a good job as and there is, of course, a backstory about reviews. Often they're written by friends of the authors. So I hasten to say that Daniel Benjamin I've never met, knowingly at least. So if you'll allow me a little bit of self-indulgence, I will read one or two sentences from that review. He says, "The tower of books that explain our misadventure in Babylon is sky high and growing. But Jonathan Steele has managed something that might have been deemed beyond reach. He's asked the question in a new and interesting way: could we have ever gotten this thing right?" Well, before I answer that question, I just want to explain the title of this book. I'm not claiming, of course, that there's been a military defeat. There's no Waterloo involved here. There's no Dien Bien Phu. I think at best it's a military stalemate, and I don't think military victory is coming, but it's not really a military defeat. What I'm talking about is a political defeat on at least four fronts, a defeat for Bush, not for the American people, although you've had to pay the price of the defeat for Bush. The first one is the issue of al-Qaeda. There was, of course, no al-Qaeda in Iraq in 2003. So when the president claimed that a significant military victory was around the corner and al-Qaeda was on the back foot, he conveniently didn't point out that al-Qaeda was not only not on the back foot in 2003, it wasn't on any foot at all. There was no al-Qaeda in Iraq in 2003. So that all that's happened is that the United States, by its invasion, has virtually invited al-Qaeda to come in, because it's much easier to kill Americans in Iraq than to get to New York these days. And now it is true al-Qaeda is somewhat on the defensive, but they needn't have been there at all if this occupation hadn't happened. So that's the first defeat for Bush. Secondly, I think the US thought they were going in there to demonstrate overwhelming military power in the region, to send a message to all Iran's neighbors and to try and reduce Iran's influence. Well, it has actually been a demonstration of impotence. 4,000 young Americans have died, 30,000 have been wounded, and Iran's influence in Baghdad has never been as high in history as it is now. Interestingly, President Ahmadinejad made a visit to Baghdad about a month ago. It was announced in advance, unlike Vice President Cheney's visit or Senator McCain's visit, and he required somewhat less security than those other two gentlemen, showing, I think, pretty graphically that Iran is more tolerated by many people in Iraq than the United States. So that's another defeat. Thirdly, I think the neocons thought that they would establish in Iraq a liberal, secular, pro-Western regime, which would be a model for the rest of the region. Well, no sane country in the Middle East wants to emulate the model of today's Iraq. And of course, it isn't secular, it's religious. The people in charge are political Islamists. So again, a defeat for this neocon policy of trying to create this secular model. And finally, of course, Bush thought that he would, by toppling Saddam, enhance the solidarity and sympathy which most people around the world gave to the United States after the terrible events of 9/11. But in fact, all that's happened is that as a result of this occupation, the US image and reputation has taken a nosedive, not only in the Muslim world, but of course in Europe, Latin America, Asia, and virtually every continent. So that is why I'm calling it a defeat. It's a defeat for the Bush policy. But then why has it gone wrong? And could it ever have gone right? The conventional wisdom, which I'm challenging in this book, is well known, that the US went into Iraq without a plan. You hear this kind of argument constantly on the TV and a lot of the punditry and from politicians as well. Argument number two is that it then made a series of blunders. It dissolved the Iraqi National Army. It got rid of the Ba'ath Party. Well, of course, these things were blunders. But if you just think about this argument for a second, it rests on an assumption. The assumption is that there could have been such a thing as a successful occupation. If only the Americans and the British had been more intelligent, more sensitive, more culturally aware, better managers, etc., there could have been a successful occupation. Well, I think that this flies in the face of history, common sense, and the tradition of the Arab world, because the two countries that invaded were the countries that already had a century-long history of intervening. The British colonized Iraq in the 1920s. They imposed a Sunni monarchy. They put down with brutal repression the insurgency and the resistance that developed at that time. Then, of course, when the sort of British imperial power collapsed in the 1950s, and the US essentially sort of took up this imperial role, particularly in the Middle East, with constant interventions to topple regimes and prop up unpopular regimes in Lebanon, elsewhere, currently very strongly supporting Saudi Arabia, etc. Arabs were aware of that. People here may not have known that history. People in the White House may not have known that history, but Arabs were well aware of it, so they were bound to treat a new occupation with enormous skepticism. But there was this simplistic view here that if you toppled Saddam, who was indeed unpopular, very few Iraqis supported him, that you'd get a blank check just to stay there, rest on your laurels for having liberated the country. And they even argued that anybody who was against the invasion must be pro-Saddam. It was a completely false argument, as I found out particularly when I went to Amman. Suddenly it dawned on me that there was this fantastic resource right at our doorstep, Iraqis, that you could talk to. See, our colleagues who were in Baghdad really had very great difficulty in talking to Iraqis in a normal way, because you had to have a minder from the regime with you at all times, or a translator. And so any interviews you tried to do with Iraqis were obviously conditioned by that. They wouldn't really tell you what they believed. And in fact, it was hard to find anybody who was willing to be interviewed anyway. But here we were in Amman, and there were 300,000 Iraqi exiles on our doorstep. So I spent quite a bit of time interviewing people, young, old, rich, poor, Sunni, Shia, religious, secular, students, artists, businessmen, all kinds of people, a whole range of society. And I found that people were very, very torn over whether they wanted this invasion or not, because nobody likes to be invaded, even if it's for an allegedly good purpose. There was one man who was a Sunni, who was a butcher, who'd left 5 years earlier, spent 5 years in Amman, and he sort of encapsulated this kind of dilemma. He said, I want the war to happen, I don't want the war to happen. I want Saddam to be toppled, I don't want my country to be invaded. And then there was an art teacher I spoke to, an elderly man who was a Shia, who favoured the invasion. He used a rather graphic metaphor. He said, the scorpion has to be stamped on, meaning Saddam, obviously. If it's not an Iraqi shoe, then let it be an American one. But then he went on to say that he was worried that the Americans might not leave quickly after having stamped on the scorpion. And this is what he said. The Iraqi people will rebuild their house the day after Saddam goes. If the US tries to meddle, we will fight them to the last breath. Iraqis hate Saddam, but they love their country more. And I think when we finally got into Baghdad, just after the statue came down, we found the same kind of attitudes repeated that I'd got in Amman. By then, of course, Saddam had been toppled. The statue had come down. And I went to see, I found a Shia to be my translator. He took me to the house of his brother, and he was a man in his early 30s. So I said, well, what do you think now? He said, Saddam betrayed us. I was completely taken aback. Just didn't seem to fit at all. So I said, can you explain? What do you mean Saddam betrayed us? He said, he didn't organize any resistance to the fall of Baghdad. So there again you had it, this feeling of humiliation somehow that other people had come in and toppled Saddam. And there were foreigners now in our streets, tanks and troops. And this was an affront to people's dignity, even though Saddam had been toppled. So how could the British and the Americans have got this so wrong? Why didn't they understand all this? Well, one thing was that they had the wrong template. They thought that it was going to be like Germany and Japan in 1945, which, of course, were successful occupations, which lasted many, many years. And, of course, there was no resistance of any kind, let alone any armed resistance. And Bremer, Jerry Bremer, you know, the first overlord of the occupation, he actually said in his book, My Year in Iraq, my idea was that we should create a success here in Iraq that, like Germany and Japan, would last for 50 years. And many of the people who flew into Baghdad in those first planes to take over the occupation, the Americans, were reading books about Germany and Japan. Very few of them were reading books about Iraq. It was quite extraordinary. But then, you see, they went into the green zone. And they had very little contact with Iraqis, except the ones who wanted to be nice to them because they wanted American money. So the Americans, if they talked to Iraqis at all, spoke to a very selected and selective group of people. And then, of course, there was this blank check idea, this false assumption that if you were pro-liberation, you would be pro-occupation. But I think it was this thank you and goodbye mood that was dominant. And in fact, the first opinion polls that were conducted in Iraq in 2003 showed this, because there was a poll done by a group which the State Department also used, a polling group, so it was considered respectable. And they asked people in October 2003, just go back to April in your mind and tell us, did you think it was liberation then or an occupation? 46% said we thought it was an occupation, and only 38% said we thought it was a liberation. And then they were asked, well, now it's October, 6 months later, what's your feeling now? Those who thought it was an occupation had gone up to 66%, and those who thought it was a liberation had dropped to 15%. So already in that first year, the vast majority of Iraqis felt it was an occupation. And I remember going to Fallujah 3 weeks after this statue came down in April, the end of April. And there was a very interesting little episode. We'd heard that something had happened the previous night, and 17, or a large number at that stage, we weren't sure of the exact number, of Iraqis had been killed by the Americans. So we went down there to find out what had happened. And it was the first big incident, I think, where quite a large number of people were killed. And we discovered that 3 weeks after the invasion, the 82nd Airborne Division did appear in Fallujah. And they set up a guard post, heavily armed sort of guard post on the roof of a building right next to the mayor's office. Now, by then, the old Ba'athist mayor had been thrown out, and the tribal elders and the sheikhs and the imams had chosen a new man to replace him. And the police were coming back into action. So there was already a new Fallujah, a non-Ba'athist new Fallujah there. The town had liberated itself. But the 82nd Airborne Division comes, sets up this guard post. They put up roadblocks, checkpoints. They demand people's identity. And they take over a local school for the troops to sleep in. And people were naturally rather annoyed. And the school was right opposite a row of houses. It was sort of middle-class suburb. And the troops were on the roof at night with these night vision goggles. And people wondered, you know, what are they looking at? And there were these impressions that somehow they could look through the curtains into bedrooms. And there was this sense that, you know, these people are overlooking us in a way that is unnecessary. And they're also occupying our school. So a protest march was organized. And it's not entirely clear what happened, but for some reason the Americans shot and 17 people were killed. So we asked local people and the American commanders what happened. The Americans told us that somebody in the crowd had fired at the school, and they therefore were obliged to return answering fire. So I was there with a lot of other reporters. You know, let's find the evidence, the obvious thing. So we looked at the front of the school to find the bullet holes, you know. There weren't any. no bullet holes of any kind. So one had to assume that if somebody had indeed fired, they were firing into the air over the heads of the above the school and not at the school. And therefore, there didn't seem to be any legitimate reason why anybody would have to return fire. The troops weren't really under any threat, and certainly not fire to the extent that 17 people were killed, that there were vast holes in the masonry of all the houses opposite, stones had come down, and so on. So I went up to the colonel called Eric Nance and asked him whether he'd ever thought of keeping the troops perhaps outside Fallujah, not in the town, in a school. And this is what he said. He said, no, I never actually considered that at all. If you want to help the Iraqis build themselves up, you have to be in there with them. We had no idea we weren't wanted. Well, I think he actually was reading me the epitaph of the whole occupation. We had no idea we weren't wanted. Because opinion poll after opinion poll has shown that Iraqis want this occupation to end and want the Americans and the British to leave. And that's been consistent all the time. And it wasn't just in the Sunni areas. It happened in the Shia areas too, because this went completely against the US assumptions. They thought because the Shia had been so brutally repressed by Saddam, they would undoubtedly welcome a liberation. But it didn't mean they wanted an occupation. They were just as much nationalist Iraqis as the Sunnis. So as long as the occupation was open-ended and no date was given for withdrawal, the Shia soon became suspicious. Bush, after all, had said mission accomplished on May the 3rd, 2003, and Iraqis said, well, yes, the mission is accomplished. Saddam's gone. There are no weapons of mass destruction. So why are you still here? There must be another agenda, some imperial agenda. But then, of course, there's also the issue of counterinsurgency tactics, and I think I'll end on this so that we have some time for questions and discussion. The episode in Fallujah that I've described, I think, was in a way the spark that lit the whole insurgency. There was no need for that heavy-handed response. It alienated hundreds of people, but it wasn't unique. In the remaining 3 weeks of April 2003, after the statue had come down, according to the Iraq Body Count, which is this very respected group that tries to tally the number of civilian casualties, and they have quite a conservative methodology. They check out reports, and there have to be at least two sources before they recognize it as legitimate. They calculated that 266 civilians were killed by the Americans in the 3 weeks of April 2003 after Saddam had been toppled. They were shot at roadblocks, they failed to see some sign to stop, maybe in the darkness or something, and were shot. Or like the Fallujah incident, there was some overreaction to perceived fire coming from Iraqis against the Americans. In the first 2 years of the occupation, up to March 2005, again according to Iraq body count, 2,654 unarmed Iraqis were killed by the occupation forces, including the British, but mostly by the Americans. Now, you have an image, and I had an image, that the main threat to Iraqis comes from car bombs and suicide attacks. But the figure that I've just given you, 2,654 dead Iraqi civilians in the first 2 years, is four times the number killed by suicide bombs and car bomb attacks in that same period. So despite the image, the Americans in the first 2 years of the occupation were actually killing four times as many civilians as Al-Qaeda or anybody else. Now, that is not generally known, but you can look up the figures in the Iraq body count and you'll see that that is the case. But I think the thing was doomed from the start. The only way the Americans could have left with some kind of dignity and honor would have been if, very soon after toppling Saddam, they'd announced that within, say, 6 to 9 months, we're leaving. We've done what we had to do. It's up to the Iraqis to choose their own government. We're not going to interfere anymore. We're leaving. But that wasn't to be. Of course, the neocons never wanted a short occupation. They always wanted a long one. And so, as I say, the occupation was doomed to defeat as soon as Bush decided to stay in Iraq, having toppled Saddam. Well, I think I'll stop at this point so that we can have some discussion. Thank you.
I'd like to ask you a question about how governments make decisions these days. Let's say you have the case of the United States and Iraq. There's virtually no debate, little debate in Congress. The media, I think, basically folds. The American people are kind of bludgeoned in or frightened into compliance. And in many respects, there's almost an institutional collapse when dealing with this question. And at the end, you have probably a very small group of people who are making these kinds of decisions, almost like a kind of third world dictatorship. I mean, is that an overstatement? And if it isn't, did the same pattern repeat itself in England? How did Britain arrive at the same conclusion when they should have known better, given their history?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And there is a big similarity, because the opposition party in Britain, the Conservative Party, supported the invasion of Iraq. It was put to a parliamentary vote, and they supported it. Similarly, the Democratic Party here pretty much gave Bush the authorization for the invasion too, so that it was a bipartisan war in both countries, unfortunately. And even now here, since the November 2006 congressional elections, which, as I understand, were fought largely on the issue of Iraq, and the Democrats won because of their perceived opposition, and then they don't seem to have followed through very effectively since then. I mean, I've actually written a slightly self-serving post on Huffington Post blog. Self-serving because I say the Democrats should use the defeat word. Because I'm imagining a scenario that a Democratic president is elected this autumn and then fulfills his or her campaign promises and starts withdrawing troops from Iraq in about the first 6 months or so. Then, of course, what will we see? We'll see the Republicans shouting defeat, defeatism. You're surrendering, you're quitting. We don't quit under fire, but you are. And they'll be using the D word against the Democrats. And, of course, it'll be pure political spin. But I think the Democrats should do a political preemptive strike now. And let's have hearings, you know, in the US Congress and the Senate on the reasons for defeat, the lessons of defeat, so that you nail it on the Republicans, or they nail it on the Republicans, the Democrats. And I think a sustained period of hearings where we get away from the sound bites that are characterizing the current political debate in this country about Iraq, with some real analysis of what went wrong, who told Bush what, why didn't they understand the political consequences of invading Iraq, why didn't they see what the forces were that would take over in the vacuum of Saddam, why didn't they understand that Islam was on the rise in the Sunni and the Shia communities, you know, who told Bush what the options were, did anybody look at the post-invasion options? I think that would be really important to get out on the table and get it out now, because, you know, the fingerprints on this disaster are Bush's. They're not the Democrats, and I think the Democrats would do themselves a lot of good if they used the defeat word now. It would also help to unify the party, for one thing. I mean, they may not agree entirely on what to do next. Some Democrats want pull out, some seem to support the stay the course line, some are for Obama, some are for Clinton, but at least there might be some party unity on looking at recent history and saying, you know, why did Bush and his Republican Party get it so wrong?
You said that if we had left a few months after we got in, we could have left with dignity. Can we leave with dignity 6 months, in 6 months or so, like Senator Barak, I think, is working towards that aim? And also, by the same token, how did things go with the British retreating, you know, leaving in the South? Is that with dignity, with success, or is it just defeat?
I think it was defeat, although I understand, obviously, nobody likes to admit defeat. But I think it is a fair characterization. But, I mean, the one good thing that you can say about the British effort in Basra, it was that from about the mid-2004 onwards, the British realized that they could not influence any longer the internal debate among Iraqis, and that all we could do was provide some kind of security at the margin, that we couldn't intervene politically. The number of attacks actually has gone down since the British pulled out. There are now 4,000 of them at the Basra airport. They don't do anything anymore in the city. And it's actually become somewhat calmer, which I think is a hint that maybe if the US starts to withdraw, things may become calmer. Because after all, I mean, if the US announces an early withdrawal and Iraqis see that it's not a trick, that it's beginning to happen, the first troops are actually leaving, then al-Qaeda loses all rationale for being there. I mean, it's already on the defensive, because the Sunni Arabs have stood up against it and said, we don't like the way you're provoking civil war. We don't like these attacks on Shia civilians. You know, get out. You're foreign as much as the Americans. We've had one invasion from the Americans. We have another invasion from these jihadis from Saudi Arabia and Yemen, Algeria, etc. And, of course, when the Americans do start going, then al-Qaeda loses its rationale. So I think it would change the entire political dynamic inside Iraq if there was a clear announcement of an early U.S. withdrawal.
One of the great strengths of the erstwhile Manchester Guardian, now the Guardian, is to still carry Doonesbury and Dilbert, although I think that a younger Winston Churchill might well want to throttle you. A great problem remains the difficulty of corruption and how to deal with that. So now, how do you maintain true stability, since people giving interviews to journalists who are from other countries run the risk of getting killed?
Well, you mentioned Winston Churchill. He gets a mention in my book to show that his understanding of Iraq was about as good as President Bush's. When they were planning to install Faisal as the king of Iraq, he sent a request for guidance to one of his staff on the 14th of June, 1921. He said, "Let me have a note in about three lines as to Faisal's religious character. Is he a Sunni with Shi'i sympathies?" He spelt it S-H-A-I-H. He didn't get the spelling right. "Is he a Sunni with Shi'i sympathies or Shi'i with Sunni sympathies? Or how does he square it? Which is the aristocratic high church and which is the low church? I always get mixed up between these two."
I suspect if everyone gets out, there'll be a bloody revolution which will make Iran's death squads look tame.
I think, you know, it's a very, very important point. Will there be a terrible bloodbath when and if the Americans pull out? But I think the encouraging point one has to make is that this Shia versus Sunni stuff is unknown in modern Iraqi history. Of course, those divisions exist, but they've never been politically important, and they've certainly never reached this level of violence in the past. People often didn't know or care whether their neighbors were Sunni or Shia. People in college they were meeting, there was a lot of intermarriage, particularly, you know, among middle-class people in the cities. So I think it's a cancer that's been artificially injected, largely by al-Qaeda, but to some extent by clumsiness of the occupiers in trying to define people all the time as Sunni and Shia and raising this awareness of people's identity. But it's been going on for 3 or 4 years, and although it's, you know, there have been a terrible number of deaths and there's a lot of bitterness and desire for revenge and resentment and suspicion and distrust and so on, I think it is reversible. It's not like Yugoslavia. Some people say, oh, well, of course, you know the Serbs and the Croats and the Albanians have been at each other's throats for years and so on, and as soon as the dictator Tito was removed, it was bound to sort of surface. Well, that's not actually the case in Iraq. You can't use that analogy for Iraq. So, again, I think as soon as it's clear that the occupation is about to come to an end, I think there is a chance. I mean, I can't predict the future with certainty, of course, but I think there is a chance that Iraqis will look into the abyss, as it were, and say, we're now in charge of our own country. We're taking the sovereign decisions, and we don't want to go on with this Shia Sunni thing anymore, and we must patch the thing up. And so the forces of reintegration may dominate over the forces of separation. I mean, in the first year when these killings were beginning, it was remarkable how the leaders of the various communities, both the Sunni imams and the Shia religious leaders, kept saying, don't let us be provoked into sectarian tension. We don't want a civil war. It's outsiders who are doing this. We're all Muslims. It doesn't matter whether it's Sunni or Shia. So I think, as I say, it is a cancer and it may spread, but I think it's still early enough, it's been detected enough, that it could be cured and reversed. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.